Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It probably would have been better if traders had just kept an eye on East Coast weather today and stayed home. Instead, they hauled themselves out in a blizzard to react to the news about AIG. Dow 6700, anybody? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Monday. Today is the 2nd of March. Another day, another $30 billion down the financial sinkhole, otherwise known as American International Group. The running tab for the government's bailout of AIG is now more than $180 billion. The Treasury Department and the White House each said today more may be necessary, and that's not entirely out of the question. Alongside the bailout news today came word that the company lost $61.7 billion last quarter. We sent Marketplace's Steve Henn to find out why AIG keeps on losing so much money.
AIG insures lots of stuff, not just life, property, and casualty. Remember those credit default swaps? Gradient Analytics' Don Vickery says those swaps are basically insurance guaranteeing banks' investments. But AIG
did not appear to understand how to value them, and worse yet, they didn't hedge any of their risks.
Vickery says AIG was an insurance company, selling insurance without really understanding the risks.
Right, exactly.
And it's not just mortgage-backed investments that AIG's wrapped up in. The company has lots of business lines.
One of them was selling insurance to European banks.
Paul Krodowski at the Kauffman Foundation says European banking rules allow banks to hold less cash and increase their leverage.
If you went out and got insurance from a provider like AIG.
Today, AIG insures more than $230 billion in European bank investments. Many may be bad. And if AIG defaults on these policies, some big European banks could fail. Analyst Rob Haynes at Credit Sites says when the U.S. Treasury bails out AIG, it's also propping up European banks.
That's true, and it doesn't sound very palatable to a lot of U.S. taxpayers.
The total cost to taxpayers could rise to $250 billion. But Haynes says letting AIG take down Europe's biggest banks would be even pricier. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Let me pick up on Steve's point about Europe and note that at least one proposed bailout did not get off the drawing board this weekend. The Hungarian government has been floating the idea that some struggling Eastern European economies could really use a hand to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. Western Europe, of course, would have had to pick up the tab, and at a summit this weekend, they gave that idea a resounding thumbs down. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has been following along from London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
The Western members of the European Union said not just no, but heck no to this plan. Why?
In fact, it was the Germans who vetoed it. And of course, Germany has the largest, most powerful economy in the EU. So what they say goes. And the Germans have been pretty tight-fisted with their own bailouts. And also, the Germans argue that billions are already going into Eastern Europe. I mean, they point out that just this past Friday, a $31 billion package to the East was unveiled. Most of the former communist countries in the East are members of the EU. They've been getting billions of euros in aid anyway. The Germans just don't think a major new fund is necessary.
These are not, though. I mean, Hungary, Romania, the Baltic states, they're not huge economies. Why do they need $250 billion?
Well, they are small economies, you're right, but they have racked up some pretty big debts. I mean, they've become utterly dependent on Western credit. Since the collapse of communism, these countries have been struggling to catch up with their wealthy Western neighbours. Something like $1 trillion flowed into these Eastern economies during the boom. As soon as the credit crunch hit, however, that tap was turned off. Many of these economies are now facing major recessions. We could be talking about declines of 10% or more.
There's been talk about the political fallout from this economic crisis for some time. Are we seeing it now here? I mean, the division possibly of Europe?
The Hungarians are warning of something along those lines. I mean, they're talking in pretty apocalyptic terms of mass unemployment in the east, and just to get the West Europeans really worried, mass migration of people from east to west. And eventually, they say, yes, a new Iron Curtain imposed this time by the West and designed to keep the Easterners in the east, which would be pretty ironic.
Okay, but wait a second. The one thing that sort of has held Europe together for however long it's been together is this concept of the internal market. You see it in the euro, you see it in trade policies and immigration policies. You can't really seriously be telling me that this economic crisis would tear all that apart.
Politically and economically, it seems most unlikely that these former communist countries would pull out of the EU because their noses were out of joint over the failure of the West to bail them out. But this is just a further sign of strains within the European Union, a further sign that as this economic crisis deepens, countries are focusing more and more on their sort of narrow national concerns. The EU was hoping that this summit in Brussels at the weekend was going to produce a kind of common approach, a unified approach to the economic, to the global economic crisis that they would then be able to take along to the big summit, the G20 summit in London next month. Well, all this talk about a new Iron Curtain, not a good omen for any coordinated attempt to manage the crisis on a global scale.
Stephen Beard at the Marketplace European Desk in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
Americans earned more and spent more in January, so said the government this morning. Don't get ahead of yourself here, though. That increase falls firmly in the category of statistical blip. More promising was this, that on average we saved 5% of our disposable income in January. That's the highest savings rate in 14 years, and it'll be great if we can keep it up over the economic long run. But our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports that socking money away is a lousy way to give an economy a consumer kickstart.
Corey Flaker works for the Columbia, Missouri city government. She's been saving more money for the past several months, and she's gotten herself out of debt. One way is by having a friend cut her hair.
And also help my friend out by trading with her, like making her dinner or giving her a massage or something.
Americans are building up their savings to try to cushion the impact of the recession. Economists say the change in spending behavior is likely to stick, but if everyone follows Corey Flaker's frugal example, it'll be that much more difficult to reverse the economy's decline. Economist Jack Albertine calls it the paradox of thrift.
Over the long term, it's important for the savings rate in America to go up. But in the short term, it's a paradox. It will have the effect of reducing demand for goods and services in the economy. That will lower economic growth. That will make the recession worse. It is a spiral downward.
Economists say lower taxes on smaller stock market gains and a cost of living hike in Social Security benefits bumped up income and spending in January. Some forecasters say the boost in incomes will eventually take the edge off the decline in retail sales and rising unemployment. In the meantime, though, consumers who save don't bode well for the government's $800 billion stimulus package. Lower withholding from paychecks this spring, along with tax breaks and job-creating infrastructure projects, are designed to get cash flowing into the economy and not into savings accounts. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
I'm going to go ahead and give away today's musical selection right here. 6,763 was the close on the Dow. We will have all the gory details when we do the numbers. Most, or maybe even all, industries are feeling the effects of the recession. But credit card companies are caught on the horns of a particular dilemma. Not only do consumers have to spend for them to make money, but we have to use their cards to do it. So, as Marketplace's Rico Galliano reports, the world's biggest credit card issuer is changing its pitch.
For the last several years, Visa's ad slogan was, "Life takes Visa." In its commercials, the company often urged consumers to whip out their cards for big once-in-a-lifetime purchases, like going to the Olympics. Then the recession happened, and what do we think of credit now?
Credit has become a curse word.
That's Marissa Gluck, a partner at Consultants Radar Research.
So Visa needs to tread lightly in this new era of economic austerity.
The first light step, a new worldwide ad campaign. The ads hitting U.S. TV on Wednesday feature trips to the local aquarium instead of, say, Greece. Antonio Lucio is Visa's marketing chief.
It is all about everyday spending. We're not asking consumers to spend more. We're asking them to use Visa for their everyday needs and wants.
The ads also focus less on credit cards and more on debit cards. Lucio says the point is that they're easier and safer to use than cash or checks. But consultant Marissa Gluck says it's also a strategy to bring in more money, just from stores instead of debt-wary consumers.
By using their debit card, they're using savings they already have. But Visa gets to still collect fees from merchants. In other words, people don't go into debt, but Visa still makes money.
Gluck says Visa isn't the only credit card company that may be trying to make money off fees instead of consumer debt. She says American Express is now retooling to focus on its original green charge card, the one with an annual fee that has to be paid off in full every month. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace. How many times in the past couple of months have you found yourself talking about money, not just within your family or to your accountant, but at dinner parties or at the office? What used to be taboo is now acceptable because the economy is everywhere and bank accounts have become conversation starters. Behavioral economist Dan Ariely tracks those kinds of social swings. Hey, Dan, good to talk to you again.
Same here.
I want to start this time with you by saying that I'm not a cheap guy to begin with, but I'm watching my pennies. But more importantly, I'm talking about it a lot more. I mean, I'm not one to talk about money, but I think we all are talking about money more now, aren't we?
Yes, and not only are we talking about money, we're talking about money in different ways these days.
Well, how so? I mean, so what are we doing?
We're sharing with people our financial difficulties, right? We're telling people, I'm hurting, I'm thinking about not spending. I heard discussions from parents in my kid's school that are saying, you know, I'm thinking about not having a birthday party, a big birthday party for my kid. And I think the interesting thing is that all of a sudden it's okay to be stingy. Like Scrooge is back, and he's back with less social stigma against him.
Move with me up the economic food chain, though. So we've been talking generally about consumers. What about businesses? I mean, in business, you really sort of have to spend money to make money. You need to make capital outlays, and you need to build your inventory and advertising. Are businesses embracing this new frugality, and if so, at what cost?
The thing I'm seeing is a real concern in businesses. So they seem to be shrinking and holding on and trying not to do too much. Particularly, nobody's investing much more in IT, in all kinds of things. And if you think about it, both for consumers and for companies, this is the time to spend, right? If you have a job, this is the time where vacations are much cheaper. If you're a business and you want to invest in IT, this is the time that IT is much cheaper. Even consultants are cheaper. I mean, everything is cheaper. But it looks to me that that's not what companies are doing. It looks like they are bracing for an impact and they're trying to hold on to the reserves and not actually spend any money. And I think that's the place where we could actually have a long-term negative effect.
I wanted to ask you about this idea that we are talking about, that everybody is talking more about being frugal and about how bad the economy is. You know, we get a lot of letters in our inbox from listeners who say, stop being so negative on the program. You're being too negative. You're making the economy worse because you're just scaring us all. Since you're an expert in this field of behavioral economics, I mean, what's your take on that?
So first of all, I think it's true that if you closed your eyes and ignored the news completely, you would not be as depressed about what's going on because it's very hard to figure out. But in fact, I think the real key is to try and understand what is going on, not to bury completely our head in the sand, maybe bury it slightly. But try to spend effort on understanding what are the causes of this. Gain some sense of understanding, sense of control, figure out how do we make sure that we don't get into this mess again. But finally, you know, if you want some good news, I'll tell you one.
Sure.
It's good news for me.
Well, okay. By all means, do share.
I don't know if this helps you, but you know, for many years, I did research on irrationality and nobody really listened to me. People would say, oh, yes, you know, you're doing all these little experiments and you show that people are irrational here, they're irrational there, they're doing this little mistake and that little mistakes. But surely when it will come to professional people making decisions with a lot of money, clearly all of these rationalities will go away. And so when Greenspan went in front of Congress and basically said, oops, you know, this whole thing doesn't seem to be working as we expected, was very good news for my field.
Well, Alan Greenspan doing what he can to help out Dan Ariely. Dan teaches behavioral economics.
And I appreciate
it. That's right, I'm sure you do. Dan teaches behavioral economics at Duke University. His book is called Predictably Irrational. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Coming up, farmers look for homegrown profits.
The more you export raw farm from any country, you are losing actually the opportunity to add value to that material.
But first, let's do the numbers. Once AIG announced that loss, you just knew it was going to be a bad day. The Dow Industrials dropped 299 points, 4.25%, finished at 6,763, as I mentioned. That is the first time since 1997 the Dow's closed below 7,000 points. The Nasdaq dropped 54 points, 4%, closed at 1,322. The S&P 500 dropped 34 points, 4.23%, ended the day at 700, barely, we should probably say. The financial sector took a beating once again. Citigroup plunged 20%, Wells Fargo lost 10%, Bank of America was off 8% today. Airline stocks lost altitude after a report showed a much bigger than expected $8 billion loss for carriers worldwide last year. United Airlines dropped 13%. Delta and the parent company for American Airlines each lost more than 8.5%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.87%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up on Tuesday. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown meets with President Obama at the White House. The Senate Budget Committee holds a hearing on short and long-term budget challenges. And on March 3, 1931, the Star-Spangled Banner was adopted as the national anthem. I'm Daryl Perinata.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Obama filled another cabinet slot today. At least he hopes so. He picked Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius to run the Department of Health and Human Services. Even though she's going to work for the president, she'll probably be spending most of her time up on Capitol Hill trying to get health reform through Congress. And as we saw with the stimulus package, the battle over health care will probably put bipartisanship to the test. Commentator and economist Edward Miguel says a little recent history here might be useful.
Republican majorities in Congress passed the largest expansion of federal government health spending in decades with the Medicare Prescription Drug Act of 2003, with strong support from President Bush. One has to wonder if there are more than economic ideology differences at work on either side. Even Rush Limbaugh said about the stimulus plan, "I don't think it's designed to stimulate anything but the Democrat Party." Recent economics research suggests Limbaugh may be right on the politics. My co-authors and I found that government programs powerfully impact voters. We study the South American democracy of Uruguay, where a charismatic, new, center-left president implemented a large anti-poverty program during an economic crisis. Sound familiar? We compare two groups of households, some who received large income benefits from the government versus others who failed to qualify. And program beneficiaries were 15 percentage points more likely to voice support for the political party implementing the program. Support remained equally high even the year after the program ended. U.S. history also points to persistent political legacies of big social programs. Millions of Americans who came of age in the Great Depression became loyal Democrats for life, rewarding the party that created the New Deal. President Obama promises a new set of programs, starting with the stimulus and extending into health care and beyond. And if Obama's reforms work, it's not just the economy that will get a boost. People will recognize the role government played in their ability to secure benefits like health insurance and reward his party at the ballot box later on. If the recipients of these programs are more likely to move into the Democratic column and stay there, how far might congressional Republicans go to block reforms that may resurrect the economy and improve lives, but hurt their reelection prospects? Who knows? But partisan political concerns may be just as important as economic policy details in determining the success of health care reform in this critical year.
Edward Miguel teaches at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Economic Gangsters. We'd like to hear your opinions, too. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Partisanship aside, healthcare reform is going to be as hard as it is because, well, because there are trillions of dollars on the line. In a recession, though, perhaps not as many trillions as before. A study out today from Thomson Reuters finds most hospitals in this country are feeling the financial strains. Janet Babin reports now from the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio.
If you've seen a hospital bill recently, you might find this hard to believe. Hospitals are losing money. The Thomson Reuters study reviewed data from about 5,000 facilities. Gary Pickens was the study's lead author.
About half of all hospitals are operating in the red. So this is an unprecedented historical phenomenon that we're seeing.
Pickens says as more people lose their jobs, they also lose health insurance. Patients without coverage usually pay less for the same hospital care, so hospital reimbursement rates have shrunk. Some patients are putting off procedures altogether. And just like our 401k plans, hospital investment portfolios have lost a lot of their value. Chris Ellington is chief financial officer at University of North Carolina Hospitals.
All of our cash flow is being eaten up by losses in investments, and our investment portfolio was conservative to begin with.
Some hospitals have stopped offering certain procedures and trimmed staff, but they can only cut so far. Dr. Alan Garber at the Center for Health Policy at Stanford University says hospitals will have to look for other ways to reduce expenses.
That means delaying or canceling building projects, possibly delaying the purchase of expensive equipment.
As the recession continues, Ellington at UNC expects a hospital shakeout.
There will be some winners and losers over the next year in healthcare for sure.
The closures and consolidations could leave some communities without access to the latest medical technologies or key procedures. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack has brought a little quantitative analysis to bear on the Obama administration's farm policy. The White House budget that was released last week would take subsidies away from big farming conglomerates, and instead that money would go to childhood nutrition programs. Or as Vilsack put it today, there are 30 million hungry children in America, only 90,000 farmers. Those numbers don't necessarily hold true in other countries, though. In Tanzania, 80% of the population works in agriculture. But despite global food prices that are high, most Tanzanians are still poor because much of the food grown there goes to waste. Gretchen Wilson reports now from Dar es Salaam.
Over a grill in a city park, Frank Baha sells roasted cassava, a starchy root vegetable that's now in season.
Right now, there's plenty of fresh cassava in the rural villages, but the roads are really bad, so it costs a lot to get to the cities where people want to buy it.
Cassava is a major staple food in Africa, but it has a brief shelf life. Once it's harvested, it goes bad in less than a week. Rural farmers don't have electricity for refrigerators, so they'll sell huge bags of their crops for just pennies, because whatever's left over will spoil. That's the way it is with a lot of food in Africa. It's feast or famine. So governments, NGOs, and anti-poverty groups want to increase food processing systems in Africa.
The estimate is 40 to 80% of farm products are lost before reaching the consumer.
Happiness Mchombo is with a small industries development organization, a government-backed group that wants to increase Tanzania's capacity to process food. She says canning, drying, or freezing can help get African produce out of the rural areas.
through processing, you definitely increase the shelf life, and then you can even transport it to where the market is.
Ideas like this have caught the attention of Western philanthropists. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is spending $13 million to teach rural farmers how to turn their raw cassava into flour. Nicholas Malingi is with the Tanzania Food and Nutrition Center.
This project is actually intending to improve the livelihoods and the income of the farmers.
And there's a demand for that flour. It's cheaper than imported wheat flour, and local bakeries can use it to make bread.
The small farmer from the village will benefit if we'll get linked to the market.
Activists say processing can improve farmers' returns in international markets, too. Most of Tanzania's biggest export crops, like coffee and cashews, leave the country in raw form. They're loaded onto container ships at the port and shipped to India, China, or Vietnam for processing. And that's where the real money's made.
More you export raw form from any country, you are losing actually the opportunity to add value to that material.
Krishna Kumar Pillai is with Olam Tanzania Limited, the country's biggest cashew processor. He employs 6,000 women to remove cashew shells. He'd like to hire more, but 70% of cashews here are exported for processing.
Which is actually exporting employment to India. So end of the day, the Indian women is getting that opportunity to work on that 70%.
In Tanzania, those lost jobs have led farmers to push for simple machinery to preserve food. The government's also encouraging foreign investors to open food processing factories. The hope is to raise Tanzanian farmers out of desperate poverty. In Dar es Salaam, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note in which Bank of America CEO Ken Lewis gets with the program. Lewis told the Financial Times today that it was, quote, a tactical mistake for him to have asked the government for $20 billion to help pay for B of A to buy Merrill Lynch. Not the actual asking for the money part, mind you, but how it looked. Lewis told the paper that now everybody thinks of B of A and more deeply troubled Citigroup the same way, which is, in his mind, not a great comparison, I suppose. Lewis also let on that despite calls for his resignation, he is not going anywhere, at least not until he repays the TARP money. Totals $45 billion, Lewis says, should take 2 to 3 years to pay the government back. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Monday. Today, the Dow fell 299 points, 4.25%. The NASDAQ down 54 points, 4%. The S&P 500 dropped 34 points. That is 4.67%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up tomorrow on the program, the credit crisis and pop culture and whatever the financial sector sees fit to bring us. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.